Okay, it's 4 p.m. I am going to call the January 18th meeting of the Senate Ways and Means Committee to order. Our agenda today is a public hearing on four different bills. And for the benefit of the folks who are joining us to testify, I would like to give a couple of instructions. I think members have gotten familiar with committee behavior for all of our committees when we're, on Zoom, but I'd ask members to stay on camera for the duration of the meeting with, breaks as needed. For members of the public who are in and agency staff who are on this call, if you could stay in gallery view on your Zoom, you will then be able to see all the senators and you'll be able to see the hearing timer as you speak. So you'll have a sense of what your timing is and I won't have to rudely and abruptly cut you off. But in addition, you'll be able to see people's faces as you're testifying. The way that it works is that I will recognize when it's time for public testimony for each bill. And then for folks that are scheduled to testify on that bill, the staff will transition your Zoom connection when you are called up to testify. So you'll hear me call your name and then you'll be linked into our Zoom. After you transition and you're reconnected, wait for me to recognize you before you begin speaking so we can all make sure we see you and hear you. And then once you're recognized, turn on your video and microphone. Clearly state your name for the official record and then share your testimony. After you're done testifying, staff will transition your Zoom connection back to where you can continue to watch the meeting or you can leave Zoom at that time. We have about 25 to 30 people signed in to testify on these four bills today. And so I'm gonna set the timer at 2 minutes. Folks who are here to testify, you don't need to take the 2 minutes. However, I may ask agency staff to stay on so that members can ask questions following the testimony, especially, I think that's especially maybe helpful for a couple of these bills. So those are our rules for the day. And we're just going to go right into public comment. Do I see any, do members have any questions? If you do, just do your little hand motion. And then I'll count on my vice chairs, Frocht and Robinson, to interrupt if they see that people have questions and I don't see you in my my video. The first hearing will open the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 8200, Long-Term Care Investments. We'll first have a staff presentation, and then I would like the following people to be ready to testify.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Senator Kaiser has her hand up.
Oh, thank you, Senator Robinson. Senator Kaiser, what would you like? Do you want to ask a question?
Actually, I'm going to ask a question of you. Are you going to allow the prime sponsor to speak to her bill?
I am glad you asked that question because I forgot about that part of our process. So yes, I will. So I'm going to ask Senator Kaiser and Ways and Means Committee staff to present the bill. First the staff, then Senator Kaiser, and then called up first for public hearing will be Bill Moss, Ben Vichti of DSHS, and Luke Masselink from the Office of the State Actuary. So I think, is it Julie? In real life, you can see who's sitting in front of you. Julie, could you give us a briefing on this?
Sure. So for the record, Julie Murray, staff to the committee presenting Senate Joint Resolution 8200. In 2019, the state enacted a long-term services and support trust program, which is a long-term care insurance benefit for all eligible Washingtonians funded by worker premiums. Under this law, individuals have access to a lifetime benefit of $36,500 that will be adjusted annually by inflation. Beginning in January of 2022, workers will pay an initial premium of 58 cents per $100 of earnings to fund the long-term services trust program. Beginning in January of 2025, workers who have vested in the program and need long-term care will be able to access their benefits for a wide range of services and supports. Beginning in January of 2024 and biannually thereafter, the worker premium rate shall be set by the Pension Funding Council at the lowest amount necessary to maintain the actuarial solvency of the trust. It is also required to set the rate using a maximum rate of no greater than 58 cents per $100 of earnings. Revenues from these premiums must be deposited into the trust fund and invested by the State Investment Board. The State Investment Board uses a long-term diversified investment strategy that has generally produced a rate of return in excess of 7%. However, due to constitutional constraints, the State Investment Board cannot invest the long-term services and support trust fund using this strategy. The state constitution prohibits the state from being interested in the stock of any company, association, or corporation, and this provision has been interpreted to mean that the state cannot invest public funds in stocks or equities. As a result, most state investments are limited to fixed income securities such as government bonds. In the past, some state funds have been specifically exempted from this constitutional restriction through a constitutional amendment. And those funds currently include public pension and retirement funds, the industrial insurance trust funds, and funds held in trust for the benefit of the persons with developmental disabilities. In order to allow the State Investment Board to invest the long-term services trust fund using its long-term diversified strategy, in 2020, the legislature passed Senate Joint Resolution 8212 and proposed a constitutional amendment to add funds for long-term services and support to the list of the public funds exempt from the current constitutional investment restrictions. At the general election, the proposal was rejected by a vote of 46% voting to approve and 54% voting to reject. The measure received majority approval in only three counties, Jefferson, King, and Whatcom. Recently, the Office of State Actuary requested the help of Milliman to provide an actuarial analysis of the Long-Term Services Trust Program as required by law. The report highlighted that the impact of the state's investment strategy has on the premium rate for the trust program. In general, it said that without the passage of Engrossed Senate Joint Resolution 8212, a premium rate of 64 cents to 69 cents per $100 of earnings would be required to maintain the solvency of the long-term services trust program over a 75-year financial horizon. Senate Joint Resolution 8200 would do is again propose at the next general election to add funds to provide for long-term care services and support to the list of public funds exempt from the current constitutional investment restrictions. There is a fiscal note, and it notes a cost of $124,000 for the general election costs. With that, I would answer any questions, and we do have staff from DSHS, State Investment Board, and the actuary to respond to questions.
Thank you, Julie. I would ask that we pull the bill report off the screen so we can all see the gallery. Great. And then I did not call up Chris Phillips from the State Investment Board, but if he could join us too to help answer questions, I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Senator Schessler has a question for Julie.
Senator Schessler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question of the State Investment Board, really. What investment window do we look at for the funds from this? Is it the long term, or is it shorter term, or intermediate?
Yeah, I do believe that would probably be a better question to ask to the state actuary.
Okay, well, if they get up there, I'd be interested in hearing.
Yeah, Senator Schessler, they will testify after Karen Kaiser speaks to her bill, and then we can make sure they address that question. I see Chris Phillips has joined us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, Senator Kaiser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing this Senate concurrent resolution. Last year, any of you who were here last year probably remember, we had a very similar measure before us. The only difference has to do with the dates. And it passed the House with a vote of 96-1, and it passed the Senate with a vote of 45-3. This bill really simply unifies or simplifies the investment so that the state investment board would treat the trust fund of the long-term services and supports program the same as we do our pension system, our workers' compensation system. Those are huge funds that earn good returns because our state investment board does a very good job. If we don't have this ability, it means that the only thing that the long-term services and supports trust fund could be invested in would be very low rate long-term certificates and treasury bond type instruments. So the bill before you simply brings forward this issue again for the public, hopefully, to consider. Sadly, the election last November was a little overwhelming. Between the pandemic and the presidential race, a lot of people overlooked and really did not understand this measure. I think with the attention of the public focused on this a little more clearly, we'll have a better outcome. The public did support having our retirement and our worker comp programs funds invested by the state investment board in the past. So hopefully we can achieve a little more focus and success, because if we don't, the program will be facing approximately a $15 billion unfunded liability. That's the difference in the investment returns. And that means that the premiums paid by working people would have to be increased significantly. The premium rate is in the statute, so we would have to go back to the underlying statute to adjust the premium rate. It's quite difficult to do those kinds of things in hindsight. So the board of the LTSS Trust Commission suggested we give this issue another bite at the apple, and that's why this measure is before you. And I would like to ask either Bill Moss or Ben Vate with the program to discuss the Milliman analysis as well. And with that, thank you very much for hearing this.
Thank you, Senator Kaiser. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay. Seeing none, I do want to give credit where credit's due and acknowledge this was Senator Braun's bill last year. So we'll try it again.
Yeah.
First folks up, Bill Moss and Ben Bakhti. And Bill, Ben, you're going to just have to say your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Moss. I'm Assistant Secretary for the Aging and Long-Term Support Administration. Here today to urge your support of SJR 8200. We really do feel like it's very important for the Washington State Investment Board to be able to create a more robust investment package for the Long-Term Service and Support Trust to produce better or more robust earnings. Without that, as you heard earlier testimony, folks that are paying those premiums for the long-term care benefit are going to be paying at 66 cents per $100. If in fact the bill succeeds and an initiative passes, our premium payers could expect, we project, will pay around 55 cents per $100, which is 3% below the current legislative amount of 0.58. So really urge your support of this bill. I'm gonna turn it over to Ben to talk in a little more detail about the Milliman report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Vecti. Thank you for pronouncing it correctly, Director of the LTSS Trust at DSHS. Assuming that keeping premiums low is a policy goal for the trust, this resolution would serve that goal in a significant way. The trust is entirely self-funded. It collects premiums from workers and investees. The higher the trust fund's investment returns, the less premium revenues will be needed to fund the benefits. Allowing the trust to secure higher investment returns will thus keep the premium rate low over the long term. to be clear, some critical context is important here. If SJR 8200 were to not pass, or the ballot initiative were not to be approved by the voters, this would still not create an urgent need for action. If the trust cannot invest in stocks, the trust fund will still be able to pay 100% of benefits through 2075. At that point, it would not become insolvent or receive any money from the general fund. Rather, it would limit benefit payments to what could be paid with incoming premium revenues. After 2075, the trust could still pay 3/4 of benefits approximately through 2096, which is the end of the 75-year actuarial projection period, from incoming premium revenues. Passage of SJR 8200 and approval by the voters would extend the ability to pay full benefits through 2096. So I just want to give some context there because I think it's important to understand that we're not talking about choice between solvency or insolvency or something like that. We're talking about fully funding the program and keeping the premium rate low over the long term so that the full benefits promised in statute can be paid through the full 75-year window without having to either increase premiums or restructure benefits to do so. If 8200 were to fail without the ability to secure higher investment returns, changes to various aspects of the program design would be necessary, such as benefit structure or eligibility. You could either restructure benefits, or you could reduce benefits, or you could increase premiums. Any of those three things could be done to make sure that the program can pay full benefits over the 75-year period.
Ben, thank you. That was helpful, very helpful information to share. The next folks up are Chris Phillips and Luke Maslink. And then I'm going to open it up to questions from members for our agency leads. So Chris Phillips, would you like to go?
I can. I hope you can hear me okay.
We gotcha.
Great. Senator Rolfe, members of the committee, Chris Phillips at the Washington State Investment Board. To answer Senator Schessler's question, we would view this as a long-term investment. We essentially view all our core competency is long-term investing on behalf of a variety of stakeholders, all of them with long-term needs. I think the distinction comes, the variability comes in when you have varying degrees of liquidity or cash demands required by different programs at different times. So when we have a higher need for near-term cash liquidity, let's say paying tuitions for the GET program, or in this case, benefits for beneficiaries, we would design the investment program for the long-term, but with enough liquidity during the periods that the assets are needed so that those payments can be made. So the asset allocation is the tool that we would use to create a designed investment program that would satisfy short-term needs for cash and long-term needs for growth. I won't belabor the earlier points have already been made by Ben and Bill and others, but the amendment would allow the latitude that the WSIB needs to create a long-term program fully diversified across stocks and bonds, as we do with many other programs. So that's really it's about the latitude from our standpoint in being able to design a fully diversified investment program. And with that, I think I won't get into the details of the investment design because we haven't done that work yet. That's due to take place this year. But the amendment would very much affect how we design that plan, whether we design a year of cash vehicles or a fully diversified design. And so the sooner we can get clarity on that, the more work we can do on that investment plan design.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Yeah, welcome any questions.
Is there, I would like to hear from Luke first, and then we'll open it up to questions in general. Luke, are you on?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Luke Maslenik, Senior Actuary with OSA. Apologize in advance. My summary might be a little technical and number heavy. I'm mostly just repeating the information in our fiscal note little bit of background. Our office has a statutory role for this program to report on program solvency and to make recommendations on achieving and maintaining trust solvency. And as noted, we currently contract with the consultants at Milliman to prepare the necessary actuarial analysis. So in terms of solvency under current law, which is based off of the lower risk, lower returning asset classes, and looking at the most recent analysis available and all of the assumptions that go into Milliman's model, if we assume no increase to the maximum premium rate of 0.58%, we expect the LTSS trust account balance would be depleted in the year 2076. After that, we estimate the program would have sufficient funds to pay about 70% of full program benefits starting in that year. At that point in time, the amount of benefits going out will be limited to the amount of premiums coming in. You'll be in kind of a pay-as-you-go situation. If this resolution passes and voters approve the ballot measure, we anticipate the trust account will have the flexibility to be invested in other forms of higher risk, higher returning asset classes. Higher levels of investment income will decrease the required program premiums. However, higher levels of investment risk increase the chance that future investment returns may fall short of expectations. Milliman also performed analysis assuming this resolution passed and voters approved it. And based on an investment mix of 30% equities and 70% fixed income, they show that the program is projected to have sufficient revenue to pay all future benefits during the next 75 years, projected to be solvent over the next 75 years if this passes. I should note, even if this resolution doesn't pass, the plan may not always be projected to be solvent. Milliman estimates that the required premium range could fall anywhere between 0.51% and 0.67% to cover all future benefits in the next 75 years. That's even if this resolution passes. And that range is based on modifying some key non-investment assumptions. All of that is to say, we will continue to update our analysis as key decisions and program experience emerges. These are point in time measurements. So it follows that as new measurements come into play, those results can change. Their study, as well as our solvency report, is on our website. We also anticipate posting some additional summary analysis to our website this week. And that concludes my prepared remarks. Happy to take any questions.
Great, thank you. Members, are there any questions from committee members for any of these fine people who have joined us today?
Senator Leas raised his hand.
Senator Leas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Luke. You mentioned that based on the non-amendment assumptions, the fund would be solvent through 2076, which seems longer than I would have predicted. Can you sort of give a sense of what are some of the factors that allow it to be solvent for, you know, around 50 years, even at the lower investment threshold?
Sure. One thing is we're collecting premiums starting in 2022. And then benefits don't begin being paid until 2025. And even then it takes some time for kind of a more mature, you know, kind of benefit, you know, payment program to really emerge. This is a new program. It takes time to be vested. And so that's part of what's going on. And the, I guess the other thing I would say, based on the Milliman assumptions, they're not assuming the trust program to be earning, I heard the number 7.5% or something before, like a pension program. It's still assuming a more modest return, but just take into account some equity type investments to estimate a slightly larger estimated return. Does that help, Senator Leas?
Are there other questions? Senator Robinson, thank you for calling these out. Please continue to do so. I'm having technical problems with my
view. So now Senator Carlisle and Senator Linda Wilson have their hands up.
Senator Wilson.
I think Senator Carlisle was before me.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I just have a question. So if, I mean, I thought that the urgency to do this last year was because this was going to have a $15 billion unfunded mandate, right? So if the case is that we don't pass this and it's only, and it's funded for 50 years through 2076, then I'm not sure why we're doing this now. Can you explain that for me? Whoever, I'm not even sure who.
I could speak to that, or Luke, do you want to go ahead, Luke, or do you want me to?
Please do, yeah.
So every year of revenue that you don't invest fully with a full diversified portfolio costs you, it compounds over time, right? The effect of not investing, just like with our own retirement, if we wait till we're 50 to start investing in retirement, we have to pay a lot more at that point than if we started at age 30 or 40, right? So it's a similar effect here. So the early years have a compound effect. I don't know, Luke, if you want to add more to that.
I don't think so. I think that captures it well, Ben. I mean, I think the, in some of the information that we'll be putting on our website, one of the key points that we try and make is that, you know, depending on when action is taken, whatever that may be, certainly impacts the kind of the size of that impact that and the size of that action that needs to be taken in order to eliminate any sort of projected deficit. So,
Senator Carlisle.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My question might be for staff as well, potentially, but I'm curious about the delineation between the benefits and the tax revenues that are generated. What is the time and delay between if you have lower than expected margins or lower than expected returns, how many years until there needs to be a course correction, either in terms of adjustment to benefits or adjustment to the tax level?
I'm opening that up to whoever wants to jump in. Luke?
Sure. As I shared earlier, we're going to be putting some summary information on our website this week that's going to get at that exact question. So let me scroll down to something that may be helpful here. So one of the items that Milliman noted was, all right, so if the goal is to, if the program is projected to not be solvent, there's only a couple ways to manage that. And two of the key approaches would be somehow reducing future benefit expenditures or increasing the premium rate. And so just to provide some context on the premium rate, under current law, Milliman states that if no change to the premium rate was made for, here it is. If 0.58% is collected for 30 years, so from 2022 to 2052, and then action was taken to change the premium rate at that time, the rate would need to increase to 0.69% in 2052 to cover future program expenditures through 2097. And then if a change was made earlier, that increase in the rate would be less than that. And so we're hoping this information, and I apologize that it wasn't ready in time for today's hearing, we're hoping this information provides some additional handles about how to interpret when action might need to be taken and how that influences what type of action or how much action would be required. Does that help answer your question, Senator?
Okay, Senator Carlisle is nodding. It sounds like we'll get more in writing.
And now Senator Kaiser has her hand up.
Yeah, I see Senator Kaiser and Senator Conway. And while they are, before you speak, Senator Kaiser, I want to make sure that Dan Murphy and Mary McCall get links in so we can hear their public testimony. Senator Kaiser.
Thank you. Maybe you met Kathy McCall.
Oh, Kathy McCall. Yes. Thank you.
Maybe. Oh, thank you. As a member of the LTSS Trust Commission, Bill Moss is the chair, or functions as our chair. And I'd like to ask Bill, if you recall, when we discussed putting this forward to the legislature, what the vote of the members were.
Thank you, Senator Kaiser. I believe the vote was unanimous. Ben, is that correct?
Yep. Yes.
And there are there are there are there, the members of the commission include both legislators and could you?
Yeah. So the members of the there are eight legislators on the commission, as well as I won't get all of them, but I'll try and remember all of them. SEIU 775 is represented on the commission. As the chair, I represent the department on the commission. Ben, can I ask for some help from Ben?
Sure, yeah. There are eight legislators, you know, four Republicans, four Democrats, and there are 10 stakeholders appointed by the governor's office, along with the heads of DSHS, ESD, and the healthcare authority or their designees. And the stakeholders include AARP, well, older adults, represented from representing older adults. Currently, that's someone from AARP, SEIU, and other long-term care providers.
Okay. Senator Conway.
And I guess my question for you is that, you know, the potential here, we've seen it with our worker comp funds when we put the State Investment Board in charge of those worker comp funds, that it not only it stabilized our funds in terms of leading to smaller and smaller increases in rates. And, you know, even though we're talking here about increasing the rate and a lot of discussion here about not, if we don't do this, the rate might have to go up. There's a potential here with investment earnings for the rate to go down. Is that correct?
Sure, absolutely.
And so if we outperform the actuary's analysis here, and I'll let you know, our State Investment Board has outperformed our, in many ways, you can look at the rate of return on the State Investment Board. It really has the potential for lowering the wage contribution to the fund, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, that I'm gonna wrap up questions from the committee and make sure we have time for the other bills that we have scheduled today. Kathy McCall, could you please start? And then Dan, please join in after Kathy's finished. Okay, not seeing that, okay, that, Kathy, good.
That, hello, whole, welcome. That mute button's always a trick.
That always gets you.
So I'm Kathy McCall, I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP here in Washington State. Thank you, Chair Rolfes, and to the committee members. I was asked to talk about the campaign. So after SJR 8212 passed through the legislature, SEIU, AARP, WACA, and other stakeholders put together a late but modest campaign because we had done some polling over the summer. We thought that it was completely fine, did some polling and found that 8212 was not going to pass with a vote of the people. But we received, in our little campaign, we received endorsements across the political spectrum and won support of every major newspaper in the state by educating people about the impact and passing the amendment. We significantly increased public support. And I personally spoke to about 30 voters who at first opposed the ballot measure, but as I talked to them about both the Long-Term Care Trust Act itself and the financial management by the Washington State Investment Board, they agreed to actually support the bill. I talked to numerous groups as well. Despite the loss at the ballot, we remain optimistic about the support for the Trust Act. The loss at the ballot was really a reflection of 2020, the economic and political realities that we faced as a state and a country. The measure was also not helped because it was last in a series of advisory votes, which had 8212 last, and it would be easy for a voter to go down the ballot and just reject all the ballot measures. Also, it was not surprising that at a time of major economic uncertainty and high volatility in the stock market, the voters were anxious about investing public funds in the stock market. The result should be viewed simply as a reflection of an understandable anxiety and not a lack of support for the Trust Act or the long-term care benefit itself, which consistently polled well. A quick post-election poll that we did after it lost on the ballot, we were offered several reasons why people voted no. By far the top response related to either opposition of investing funds in the stock market or lack of information. While 45% said that their main reason for voting was no because they didn't want to risk taxpayer dollars in the stock market, and 35% said that they were voting no either way because the measure was too confusing or they didn't have enough information. The failure of the amendment is not the impact, will not impact the implementation of the Trust Act in the short term. The impact of the lower investment returns, as described earlier, is a long-term problem. And we're going to continue to work and focus on 2021 with a new campaign. AARP, SEIU 775, WACA, and other stakeholders will continue to move forward, working with the administration and developing a better, more robust public relations and outreach campaign. AARP continues to remain committed and 100% confident in the future success of the Trust Act, and I hope that you pass SJR 8200. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Dan?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'm Dan Murphy. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Regional Council, which is the Area Agency on Aging in the northwest corner of the state. I'm also a member of Long-Term Care Trust Commission. And just as a brief reminder of what the Long-Term Care Trust Act does, if you're lucky enough to hit age 65, you've got a 7 in 10 chance of needing long-term care at some point in your life, but that can cost tens of thousands of dollars a year. It quickly devastates personal finances, and then the expense hits the Medicaid budget. And what the Trust Act does and what the trust does is add a significant additional payer for long-term care to help families and individuals with that need. And you know, I've heard the actuarial analysis. What got my attention was the simple number that I came up with, that we're talking about being able to invest the funds as this bill would allow, adds 20% to the over the long haul. And this is long-term care, so we're talking long-term financing. But it adds 20% by the Milliman estimates. I've not heard anybody, maybe it's 10, maybe it's 15. It seems like being able to use this money over the long haul to ensure the financial stability of the trust fund is something we should do. Absolutely, because there seems like there's mostly upside to this, only upside by the words that I've heard. And if we're talking 20%, we're talking $1 in $5 over the course of the duration of this benefit, or over the 75-year period. And we're talking about money that otherwise would come out of the pockets of workers or would result, as you've already heard, in the reduction of what is already a pretty base benefit. And so, you know, I chaired the group a couple of years ago, the stakeholders that looked very closely at balancing the revenues with the aspirations programmatically. And this is a pretty spare benefit. It's also a pretty limited charge for workers. And I think anything we can do to keep that balance over the long haul is a move that we should make. So that's why I believe the commission unanimously recommended we move this forward. And I would certainly urge you to do that again. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. That concludes our public hearing on SJR 8200. We're going to start the public hearing on Senate Bill 5021, Retirement Benefits. On the previous bill, we had 27 people signed in not wishing to testify, 25 of whom were pro, 2 were other, so members can see who that is and look at comments on your laptop. 5021, we will hear an overview from Amanda Cecil and then introduction by Senator Hunt.
Senator Rolfes, members of the committee, I'm Amanda Cecil, staff to the committee. You have before you Senate Bill 5021 related to the effect of expenditure reduction efforts on retirement benefits for public employees, including those participating in the shared work program. And this bill comes to you by way of request from the Department of Retirement Systems. For background, most of the state's public employees are covered by a pension plan that is administered by the Department of Retirement Systems. The most notable exception would be the large pension systems that are operated by the cities of Seattle, Tacoma, and Spokane. Generally, all other public employees are either not covered by a pension system or in one of the systems covered by Department of Retirement Systems. I won't read those off, but there is a list that started at the bottom of page 2 of the bill report that shows all of those systems. Each of those systems includes a defined benefit component, meaning that the retirement benefit is calculated based on the employee's average final compensation and years of service. And that's compared to a defined compensation plan where the retirement benefit is based on how much money was set aside and how much interest it earned. So in a defined benefit plan, an employee that's furloughed or otherwise on unpaid leave could ultimately receive a smaller retirement benefit. And this happens in one of two ways. First is if the unpaid leave happens in the period of time that the average final compensation is being calculated, that would result in a lower benefit. So for example, the public employee retirement system, PERS 2, the highest consecutive 60 months is the period by which the average final compensation is calculated. So if an employee were furloughed or on unpaid leave during that consecutive 60 months, that would result in a lower benefit. The second way that can happen is if they are on unpaid leave for enough time to lose service credits. So within most of the system, in order to earn a full service credit in a month, an employee needs to work 90 hours. So which is about 2 weeks and 2 days for an employee working an 8-hour day. So if an employee were furloughed for more than about a week and a half, 2 weeks, it's possible that they would lose service credit. So that those are the two ways that a retirement benefit could be impacted. So from there, I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about the background of the Unemployment Insurance Shared Work Program that's administered by the Employment Security Department. Under this program, an employer can temporarily reduce an employee's hours up to 50%, and that employee is eligible for unemployment insurance benefits. To be eligible to participate, federal rules require that fringe benefits, including retirement benefits, continue to be provided to shared work employees under the same terms and condition as when the employee works usual hours. And benefits provided to employees under the shared work plan are generally charged back to the employer. However, under the CARES Act and the Continued Assistance Act, the federal government has been and will continue to reimburse the states for 100% of shared work employment, unemployment insurance benefits paid through March 14th of 2021. How that plays in is, and something I failed to mention in the bill report, is beginning last June and through November of 2020, the governor instituted a total of 8 mandatory furlough days for most state employees. And each of those affected agencies submitted a shared work plan. And so those employees were on shared work. Many employees were on shared work during the 2020 calendar year. So under this bill, there's two overlapping provisions. The first provides that specified public pensions will not be reduced as a result of compensation reductions that are part of an employer's expenditure reduction efforts during the 2019 to 2021 and 2021 to 2023 fiscal biennium. So that would be the current biennium that we're in today and the next biennium. So expenditure reductions during that period of time would not result in a reduced employee benefit. And so that would apply to both their average final compensation as well as their service credits. And specifically that applies to the public employee, the public safety employees, the school employees, teachers, law enforcement and firefighter, and state patrol retirement system. So the vast majority of the state systems would be covered by that. The second thing under this bill is that it provides that a pension benefit of an employee covered by a pension system that is administered by the Department of Retirement Systems is not reduced as a result of participation in an unemployment insurance shared work program. So that's the shared work program that I just spoke about. This provision would apply prospectively and retroactively to July 28th, 2013. And the reason it applies retroactively to that date is that that's the date that a bill went into effect that made Washington State compliant with those federal rules requiring that pensions be made whole for employees taking part in shared work. So just the shared work piece is retroactive back to 2013. The bill, however, has an intent section stating that the bill is intended to be curative, remedial, and applied retroactively. And I mentioned that a second time because the first provision, while largely prospective, we are talking about employees that had furloughs in 2020. So something that already happened being covered under this bill. There is a fiscal note from the Department of Retirement Systems, which identifies them needing 1.7 full-time equivalent employees or time and about $145,000 per year in ongoing costs. And this would be related to the additional work calculating the benefits of impacted employees when they retire. So right now there's the mechanism by which they calculate it. This would add a step to that. They estimate that's about 30 minutes per impacted employee. And so they came up with an estimate of $145,000 per year of ongoing costs. As with other costs for the Department of Retirement Systems, this would come from the DRS expense account, which is funded from a fee that all the employers pay on their pensionable salary base. And this cost would not result in a need to increase that existing fee level. So while there's a cost, it wouldn't increase the fee that all of the employers pay. There's also an actuarial fiscal note showing no cost in the current biennium or in the four-year outlook. And that's because this wouldn't be expected to impact rates either in the current biennium or the subsequent biennium. There is an estimated 25-year cost based on the best information that's available. And that's $22.5 million from the general fund and $79.5 million for, across all of the employers that would be impacted. And that would be captured through future rate changes. And that's related to making whole the salary and service credits of employees that were furloughed. One thing to mention on the fiscal note, this impacts both the state and local employers. And I mentioned that because it caught me up a couple of times. For the most part, state employees have not been furloughed enough to lose any service credit and only minimally impact their average final compensation. But there's been different data received on the local government side that particularly in the school system where classified staff have probably experienced a much larger degree of furloughs that would have a larger impact on the system. And with that, if there are any questions.
Are there any questions? I don't see any hands raised. I think you wore us out on that briefing. I want to call in before Senator Hunt testifies. I want to make sure that if Patricia Daly Shives is here, that she signed in, Sean Merchant, Nancy Healy, and Julie Salvi. And then the next group coming in is Candace Bach, Philip Ferrister, Matt Zubich, and Seamus Petrie. So we'll hear from our esteemed colleague and then go into public testimony. Senator Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sam Hunt, State Senator, 22nd District. Amanda really covered it. I will just try to do it in one sentence. There will be no penalty on retirement accrual for public employees if they are subject to either decreased salary or shared work by furlough days or by shared work. So try to keep them whole. And I assume this would only account also upon payment of retirement, not on salary. So it's all retirement oriented. So that's it.
Okay, thank you. See a few folks have joined us. I'm gonna go, I see Sean Merchant first. Sean, could you begin?
Thank you, Senator Rolfes, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Hunt, for sponsoring our bill, taking the time to do that for us. Staff did an excellent and thorough job, Madam Chair, as you said, of explaining the bill, so I won't take a lot of time to go over more of that. It is two parts to the bill. One is the furlough and the other is the shared work component. The furlough piece is essentially the same as a bill that was passed in 2008, I believe, covering furloughs when the economic downturn occurred in the past, with the addition of the protection for the service credit piece to particularly protect people who might be on the bubble anyway of getting their service credit. This maintains that they in fact will get their service credit if they are furloughed. The shared work piece, as staff said, kind of picks up something that was a result of a statutory change in 2013, so that when employers who are now eligible to use shared work certify that there will be no benefits that are reduced, they actually won't be reduced when this, if this bill were to pass and be curative and retroactive. So with that, again, I think that's what we've got, and I appreciate your consideration of this bill, and I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Sean. Senator Frocht, do you have a question for Sean or a question for Amanda?
I think it's just for Amanda or Senator Hunt.
Okay, go ahead.
Could you just, I guess I'm a little bit unclear of the time frames. Does this apply only to furloughs or shared work situation that arose as a result of orders related to the pandemic or related to the state of emergency? And or is this something that we would have to readdress, let's say, in if there's another situation, a budget crisis, let's say, in the future or whatever it might be, where the same types of actions have to be taken?
Yeah, Senator Frocht, this is Amanda, staff to the committee. This is specific. So in terms of furloughs, this is specific to COVID-19 related furloughs that take place in the current biennium and the next biennium. The provisions related to the shared work would be prospective.
Prospective and not going backwards. Okay, got
it. Also going backwards. The shared work goes back to 2013 and prospective. So any shared work by a public employer, this would be covered. However, if the state were to furlough employees following next biennium and did not put them on a shared work program, their pension would not be protected under this bill. This is time limited for furloughs that are not part of shared work.
Okay. So going back, and I don't know if you know this, to 2013, let's say to the present, do we know how many employees have been on a shared work program of some at some point, or is that data we have at this point?
Prior to 2020, there's no record of any state employees being on the shared work program. It's possible that local governments had put people on shared work, but if they did, it's very minimal.
Got it. Okay, thank you very much. That helps me. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schessler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While we have Amanda up there, I have a question. Amanda, is there any place else that a defined benefit pension plan gives credit for days that aren't worked?
All of the systems have mechanisms by which an employee can buy service credit under certain scenarios, and each of the systems is a little bit different. There's also a limited opportunity for employees with specific military service credit to get free credit. Let me check and see if there's any other areas. It's possible that there are and that I just can't think of them off the top of my head.
Well, we're not talking about service credits, and we had a long discussion in the interim pension policy about military credits, trying to find an answer there, but I don't believe this happens in Social Security or anyplace else, but follow-up information would be welcome.
Let's hear from Nancy Healy and then Julie Salvi.
Hello. Are we going? Hello, Chairman Rolfes and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Healy, and I'm a member of Retired Public Employees, and I'm also the retiree member of the Washington Federation of State Employees. I speak today in support of this bill 5021. This bill will help prevent possible delays in people's retirement, and it will protect recruitment and retention of state employees. This will not have a significant effect on the state's budget, but will have a notable detrimental effect on employee budgets. Pension rights have been long fought for and need to be protected by this bill. This is the right thing to do, and we request that you show state employees and future retirees that they are valued and deserving. Please pass Senate Bill 5021. Thank you.
Thank you. Julie.
Good afternoon, Chair Rolfes, members of the committee. For the record, I am Julie Salvi, representing the Washington Education Association. As you've heard, Senate Bill 5021 is offering important protections to ensure that temporary actions taken during an economic downturn do not follow employees throughout their retirement and become permanent impacts. As mentioned before, some of these measures were taken in the Great Recession as well, and so we appreciate your consideration of these policies today. We appreciate the changes that are being made to shared work. I will say school districts don't have a long history with shared work. This was new to them this fall, but it proved to be an important tool for both employees and employers to maintain that relationship during an economic downturn, to keep staff associated with the school district so that as things changed and schools began to reopen, that they would have the school bus drivers and all of these other positions, food service workers and others who are needed to make our schools work. We appreciate that this fix is being made so that that will be another tool in the toolbox during both this pandemic and any future economic downturns. I appreciate your time. We ask that you move 5021 through the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Candace Bach.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Candace Bach, representing the Association of Washington Cities. I'm here to thank you for bringing this bill forward and ask for your support. As was noted, this does impact local governments, and I've heard from cities that they have taken steps, unfortunately, to have to furlough employees given the pandemic and the economic downturn. In a survey we conducted this fall, about 25% of the cities who responded indicated that they had used furloughs, and another 20% indicated that they'd done some form of layoffs. So we appreciate this proposal that would help those employees stay whole in the retirement system. It's never an easy decision to use furloughs or layoffs with employees. Particularly during the pandemic, some of the hardest hit employees were in our parks departments and recreation services when we just weren't able to provide those services due to the shutdown. And the ongoing use of furloughs or layoffs to manage the economic impacts of the pandemic on our budget. So we appreciate you taking this step that benefits local public employees as well. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Philip. Is Philip Ferrister here?
Yes, I am.
All right. Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Phil Ferrister, speaking on behalf of the Association of Washington Assistant Attorneys General, AWAG. I've been an attorney in the state of Washington for about 29 years, and I speak to you today in my personal capacity, not on behalf of the Attorney General's office. First, I'd like to thank DRS and the sponsors of the bill for bringing it forward. AWAG supports Senate Bill 5021 for its two critical fixes that address how the defined benefit pension formula will work for state employees affected by furloughs or shared work programs last biennium and potentially this coming biennium. The bill means that while no state employees like furloughs, that those undertaken during the last year and perhaps in the coming biennium will not affect the pensions of employees who may retire soon. This is the correct policy result. State employees value our ability to serve all Washingtonians and have shared the budgetary pain during the state's short-term needs. But employee pensions provide critical long-term income to retired state employees. Absent this bill's important fixes, state employees retiring in the next few years could be harmed by experiencing reduced pensions for decades during retirement. I know that the effect furloughs could have on retirement pensions caused a lot of concern for my fellow employees who are close to retirement. This bill clearly addresses those concerns. Thank you for the opportunity to comment in favor of Senate Bill 5021.
Thank you, Phil. And next up is Matt Zubich. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Zivich with the Washington Federation of State Employees, here to support Senate Bill 5021. First, I'd like to thank Amanda on the staff for giving a lot better explanation to this bill than I could. And I'd like to thank the sponsor, Senator Hunt, for bringing the bill forward and DRS for submitting it. Also, my regards to Ranking Member Wilson today. I think that it's been explained to you, but some things that you may not have heard is, as a result of our contract negotiations, we've agreed that we would have 2 years worth of furloughs once a month. That's going to result in about a 5% loss of income for every state employee that's having to do those furloughs. So this bill would help keep them whole in terms of their pensions and retirement. It'd be a shame if their service ended up having to cost them after they retire from public service. So I won't need my full 2 minutes to just ask you to support the bill, move it through. We did it in the last recession. We should do it here. And lastly, it's good to see you all in this, even in this format. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt. Seamus.
Yes, hi, Chair Rolfes and members of the committee. Seamus Petrie with the Washington Public Employees Association in support of 5021. I'm going to try not to repeat what other folks have said, but I appreciate the consideration of this bill. The thing I want to add is that there are employers right now who we've been working and negotiating with who are anticipating furloughs in the near future. We have asked them to hold off so that they can re-enroll in shared work. And this bill will enable them to do so that the furloughs that they are anticipating going forward are much less painful because they will be supported by the federal government with a shared work program, as well as members can be reassured that their pensions are safe. So please move this bill forward, and the sooner the better. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That concludes our public hearing on Senate Bill 5021. Our next hearing is Senate Bill 5004, and here to brief us on that is Alia Kennedy, and Senator Kaiser will speak afterwards.
All right, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Alia Kennedy, staff to the committee. The bill before you is Senate Bill 5004, which provides a tax exemption to medical marijuana patients. By way of background, patients diagnosed with a terminal or debilitating medical condition may qualify for medical marijuana use. To qualify, the patient must either have an authorization form from their healthcare provider or be entered into the medical marijuana authorization database and receive a recognition card. Under current law, medical marijuana patients are exempt from state and local sales taxes on qualifying purchases, but must still pay the 37% excise tax imposed on all marijuana products. Products exempt from sales tax include marijuana concentrates, usable marijuana, or marijuana-infused products identified by the Department of Health to be beneficial for medical use, and products containing low THC percentage. The bill before you provides an exemption to the 37% excise tax for qualifying purchases made by medical marijuana patients. It also requires marijuana retailers to maintain certain data on tax-exempt sales and provide that information to the Liquor and Cannabis Board. A fiscal note is available. The bill would reduce dedicated marijuana account revenues by about $7.5 million this biennium and $10 million in the next. The Liquor and Cannabis Board does note in the fiscal note, though, that the true revenue impact is indeterminate because the board does not know which tax-exempt sales are for qualified medical marijuana patients and which are tax-exempt purchases of the low CBD or THC products that are exempt to all consumers. And finally, there are expenditures of $22,000 this biennium and $44,000 each biennium thereafter for LCB enforcement costs. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Members, are there any questions? I don't see any hands. Senator Kaiser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill. I actually do have a question for Aaliyah. Maybe she can find out the answer while I present the bill. We currently have in our local neighborhood drugstores products called CBD products that are claiming medical benefits. And I am not clear, but I do not think those products have a 37% excise tax on them at this time. Of course, they have sales taxes, just like all marijuana has sales taxes. So just to clarify whether the market is stable that way. I brought this bill forward because what I've found is that fewer and fewer medical marijuana patients are able to find the products, the low THC products. That means they don't have much psychoactive impact. They have medical impact on situations like nausea when you're in chemotherapy or glaucoma when you're being treated. And those, which if you recall, was the reason we originally legalized marijuana, was for medical patients who needed some of the benefits of marijuana. So the bill before you is limited to DOH certified products that currently are available in small numbers at our licensed retail stores for marijuana. Medical patients tell me that they can't find many products in the stores because there's not much traffic. Once the medical marijuana providers were shut down and everything was sent to the retail stores, the medical marijuana marketplace became really limited. So patients are having a hard time finding the products they need as well. And part of that, they say, is because patients are not going to the retail stores. They're developing a gray market of their own to get their medical marijuana strains of products that are not regulated or taxed at all. So I'll just stop there and allow people to have their say. Thank you so much for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Senator Kaiser. First, our first panel will be Lara Kaminsky, Danielle Rosellison, and Lucas Barfield.
Great. Thank you, Chair Rolfes and members of the committee. My name is Lara Kaminsky, and I'm the Government Affairs Liaison for the Cannabis Alliance. We are here testifying in support today. As was mentioned, under state law, all retail marijuana sales are subject to 37% excise tax. In 2012, 5052 was passed, which allowed patients in the database to be exempt from sales tax. Patients are still, however, subject to that almost 40% tax applied to all sales. In our surveys, patients consistently indicate that 49% of them are staying out of the regulated market entirely because it does not service their needs. The top three reasons are the cost, fear of inadequate testing, and lack of appropriate products in the store. Department of Health compliant products are the only highly tested products that meet the concern that patients have regarding quality, but there is a lack of these products in the market. The LCB is delayed in their effort to mandate pesticide and heavy metal testing, leaving patients wondering how they can access safe medicine. And the cost of the few products that are compliant with DOH's standards with that 37% excise tax is far outside the range of chronically ill patients who are disproportionately poor and whose need is generally greater than a recreational consumer. The legislation removes 37% tax only on DOH compliant products to patients registered in the database, which goes a long way to address the top reasons patients are staying out of the market. Additionally, I do want to take a moment to address the fiscal note that was just attached to this legislation. It is incorrect. I say this because we went down this road last year with Senate Bill 5234, which was similar legislation. The LCB is interpreting the tax break as being applicable to all cannabis products in the store. The fiscal note needs to reflect that the language of the bill specifically says the excise tax waiver is only on DOH compliant product as defined by WAC 24670. In 2019, there was $127,000 worth of DOH compliant product in the system. If you remove the 37% excise tax on only the product correctly identified, the tax revenue lost would be closer to $47,000. So thank you for that. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
I see Senator Kaiser's hand up. Senator Kaiser, do you have a question for Lara?
perhaps Laura can tell me, do you know if the CBD products being sold in our retail drugstores now and other stores are subject to the 37% excise tax?
They are not.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Lucas, do you want to go?
Yes, hi. My name is Lucas Barfield. I'm a medical cannabis patient in the state, and I'm also on the Tacoma Commission on Disabilities. Thank you for hearing this bill. I just really want to talk real quick on who medical cannabis patients are. If you look at the list of qualifying conditions for the state, it really is quite a formidable list of conditions. A lot of people are not, there's not going to be a lot of people helped with this bill, but it will help a lot of people with disabilities. All the medical cannabis patients that I know are people with disabilities, but I am the only person that I know that is actually registered, and that is because it's actually really hard to get a registration. If you are unfortunate enough to have one of these diseases, then you have to find a doctor to give you recommendations. That's really difficult. CHI doesn't give them, MultiCare doesn't give them. There's only one in the area of Tacoma that will give them, so it's really hard to get on the registry to begin with. So next thing I want to talk about is the effect that the market has on people with disabilities' pocketbook. Personally, I am able to provide for myself a little bit, but I always have to go to the stores, and I am excluded from buying high-quality cannabis because I can't afford it. The 37% keeps me in the low range of cannabis, and it's not always the kind of cannabis that I need. Another example is I have a friend who's a veteran. He has PTSD. He uses far more cannabis than I do. We can never get him enough through the month. A lot of times I'm giving him cannabis out of my own supplies, and he still can't afford everything he needs through the month. And then finally, I have one other person just to speak on the gray market, a friend who has a disability. He is a younger person. He's been getting cannabis on the underground market for many years, and he continues to because he perceives that the cannabis there is safer and better and lower cost. So just to put a fine point on this, this really is an equitable access issue. If people who have jobs and who are working and who are not disabled can afford high quality, high grade cannabis in the stores, then certainly medical cannabis patients who most have disabilities should be able to afford it too. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if you had them. Thank you.
Thank you. Danielle. You need to unmute and start all over.
Oops, my bad. Can you see me? Okay.
Yeah, we can hear you and see you.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. My name is Danielle Rosellison. I am the CEO and co-founder of Trailblazin Productions. Trailblazin is a licensed tier 2 producer processor. We were 8th to apply for our license in 2013 and one of the first to be licensed in 2014. We are a woman-owned company, owned and operated, and 100% of our upper management employees are minorities. Also to note, 100% of the product that Trailblazin produces has been DOH certified as medical marijuana since the beginning of 2017. Out of 1,500 producer processors that are licensed in the state of Washington, Trailblazin is one of two that certify the majority or all of their product as medical. The other one is Fairwinds. I'm here today to ask you guys to support Senate Bill 5004. Why, you might be thinking, do only 0.1% of producer processors certify their product as medical? Well, let me tell you. It's expensive to grow medical cannabis, and it's expensive to test medical products. Testing costs for a farm like mine, which is just the middle size of the road, can run up to $200,000 annually for the increased testing costs. And since there's really been no education behind the Department of Health program, and the logo itself is not self-explanatory at all, we're not seeing the demand for Department of Health products that there should be. There's confusion about what DOH products are, and thus producer processors cannot get a higher price point. So farmers are basically paying a bunch more money and see no return on their investments. The ROI just doesn't pencil. Passing this bill will make sure that more retailers understand what DOH products are and that more patients and veterans in need will ask for DOH products, which means then more producer processors will certify their products as medical. Number two, currently registered patients only get sales tax off their cannabis purchases, which we've already talked about. However, the burden is such that every single retailer I know will just give anybody who says that they're a patient that 10% off. And then this leads many patients and veterans to purchase whatever suggested, which may not be what the doctor recommended. And what's to keep a retailer from just suggesting product that they get the highest ROI, but that isn't pesticide or heavy metal tested?
Danielle, do you have, can you wrap it up?
Yes, please pass this bill.
It sounds like, Danielle, before you leave us, it sounds like you had more to say. Please send it in. I think we're all interested in the rest of your remarks. Thank you.
Thanks.
Ezra Eichmeier.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great, thank you so much. This is the tax that really honestly never should have been. I can't speak highly enough about how urgent it is to pass this bill. And look, I have people come to me asking if I can help find illicit market medical cannabis products for family members of friends who have cancer or other conditions come up. I just had a friend text me literally yesterday. My mom has cancer. She needs RSO, which is an oil extract. It's very, very expensive, even without a tax and even without regulations. Can you help me find an illicit market source for this? She can't afford it from the stores. So this is going to be, to make truly medical grade products for people with real medical conditions is an expensive venture to begin with in the testing, the production, and everything else, let alone, you know, adding a 37% tax to it. I was against that, you know, when it happened, you know, a couple of years ago when these systems got merged, and it really needs to be undone right now, straight up. There's another part to the fiscal impact, though, that I think that should be considered. You know, I'm in the industry. I'm licensed. I do strategy consulting on a national basis with different companies. And as long as this tax is here, our businesses simply are not going to invest in developing next generation medical cannabis products for Washington State. Because there can't be a market for it with this tax attached to it. They're already going to be too expensive, and insurance at this point isn't covering them. So the economic development aspect of this is going to be substantial. My prediction is that when we fully develop truly medical products that are adopted into mainstream medical practice, the value of the medical marijuana market to the cannabis industry is going to be potentially bigger than the current recreational market. So I know fiscal notes can't capture that. They don't in our state. But that is a very real aspect of this as well. But mostly this is about compassion for people who are dying. Thank you.
Thank you, Ezra. I have a general question for the advocates just to work with Senator Kaiser on if there's something we can do about it, which is the potential for revenue to the state to be switching from recreational to medical as there's more, you know, as there's a clear benefit to having your medical card or purchasing it as medicine. So I just want to throw that out there. That wouldn't be captured in the fiscal note, but it's a concern that I have that as the market will switch, the consumer behavior might switch. So, and I'll follow up with you guys about that later. The next two folks are Seth Dawson. I saw you were on here, and then Jeffrey Wilhoit. Seth, would you go ahead?
Good evening. My name is Seth Dawson. I signed in other on behalf of the Washington Association for Substance Abuse Prevention because we only wanted to relay one consideration we ask you to keep in mind as you weigh the merits of this and similar bills. And that would be that generally speaking, the higher the cost of an alcohol or marijuana item, the less youth access there will be. And conversely, the lower the cost, generally speaking, the greater access youth will have to the product in question. So that's our one concern with this measure, not arising to opposition, because we do appreciate the extent to which the prime sponsor has tried to narrow the impact of the bill and yet accomplish the underlying purpose. And then finally, just a tip of the cap to your staff, because I'm a very low-tech guy, and even I can navigate these new virtual procedures, and we're very grateful for that. So thank you.
Good. Thank you, Seth. Jeffrey, you are our last person signed in to testify. Please go ahead. Unmute yourself and yep, there you are.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill. Again, my name is Jeffrey Wilhoit, and I'm testifying in support of this bill, and I would like to offer a little change to this that I feel would help support medical marijuana patients in Washington State. Under current regulations, medical marijuana patients are paying the 37% excise tax for their medicine to help alleviate cancer, HIV, multiple sclerosis, Crohn's, among a myriad of other conditions. In the state currently, all medicines other than marijuana that require a doctor's prescription or order are exempt from excise and sales tax in Washington state. So this bill would do a great thing to help bring parity with other medications offered to people in Washington state. This bill would help thousands of Washingtonians that are already struggling to pay their bills due to the burden of their medical conditions find a little bit of relief. So in the bill, section one, paragraph 2A, usable marijuana concentrate or infused product that is compliant with chapter 24670 of the WAC in order for the discount to be eligible. So this requirement would make most of the products offered for sale in retail stores not eligible for the exemption. Currently, there are only a few products that meet this requirement offered for sale, as you've heard from the other panelists. Most patients are currently purchasing medical marijuana from licensed retailers that helps alleviate their symptoms, but would not qualify under the proposed tax excise tax relief. I would ask that instead of only offering the excise tax break to the small amount of products offered that conform to Chapter 246-70, instead all products as they are currently under the registration where you get the 10% sales tax reduction, all products that are available in the regulated market would be offered this excise tax break. It would be as simple as striking one line in there, basically just allowing any product to be purchased. That's all I have. Thank you very much for your time.
Great, thank you for joining us today. That concludes our public hearing on Senate Bill 5004. There were five people signed in not wishing to testify, four pro, one other. And I neglected to say under Senate Bill 5021, there were 19 people signed in pro but not wishing to testify. And our final bill for the evening is Senate Bill 5080. We're going to hear from Jeff Mitchell first on this.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jeff Mitchell, staff of the committee. Senate Bill 5080 relates to a sales and use tax deferral program. By way of background, in 2019, the legislature authorized a state and local sales and use tax deferral for the construction of the arena that will be used for professional hockey. The deferral also applies to a professional hockey practice facility. The arena involved is Climate Pledge Arena, formerly known as Key Arena. The 2019 legislation authorizing the sales and use tax deferral on the construction of the arena and practice facility requires the state portion of the deferred sales and use tax to be paid back by June of 2023. The local portion of the deferred tax will be repaid in 8 installments beginning in the year following the year in which the project is operationally complete. At this point, it looks like the arena will be operationally complete in the fall of 2021. Therefore, the first installment will be in calendar year 2022. Under the legislation enacted in 2019, one half of the repaid local sales and use tax is collected and distributed in the same manner as other local sales and use taxes. The other half is deposited in the state building construction account, which will require a legislative appropriation. The funds must be used for the construction or rehabilitation of capital facilities providing youth educational science programming on the same campus where the arena is located. So this would be the Pacific Science Center. The bill before you today does two things. First, the allowable use of repaid local sales and use taxes deposited in the construction account is expanded to include not only capital improvements of buildings used for youth educational programming, but also the maintenance and operational activities associated with these facilities. Second, the deposit of this portion of repaid local tax will be moved from the state building construction account to the local sales and use tax account, where it can automatically be distributed by the state treasurer without requiring an appropriation. There is a fiscal note. While the bill modifies the allowable use of revenues and the mechanism of distribution, there are no changes in the bill impacting state or local revenues. With that, I would be happy to respond to any questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Kaiser, your hand is raised. Go ahead.
That's from a while ago, Senator Rolfes.
There we go. Okay. Senator Carlisle, do you want to speak to your bill?
Senator Kaiser, I couldn't get the microphone unmuted. I was trying to point out that there was another person signed up to testify on the last bill, but we didn't call on John Kingsbury.
He did not. He was not in the room when we. Okay. Is he back? If he's back, I'm happy to reopen the hearing. So let's see if we can track him down. And somebody let me know when he shows up, and we'll reopen that hearing after we're done with this. Okay. Senator Carlisle.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill. To my colleagues, last year we passed legislation authorizing a few-year tax deferral on the NHL stadium that would be repaid with interest. So this is actually a moneymaker for the state. In the language of that bill, we authorized capital investment in the Pacific Science Center, which is a few hundred meters from the Climate Pledge Arena. I would note that this is the first public money of any substance, more than $50,000 or so, that's been invested in the Pacific Science Center since 1962 when it was built. And when I say public money, I mean it's paid for by private dollars. It's just a slow loan, a couple of year loan on behalf of the investment from the sales tax paid to that facility. Pacific Science Center, like every art and cultural institution in our state, is struggling. I had originally intended to include operational capability as opposed to just capital in the original bill. I did not do that. Asking for your sincere consideration of that. Again, there's no fiscal note of state or local dollars. I have to thank the folks at the Climate Pledge Arena, the NHL, which has been extremely helpful in this, as well as the City of Seattle, King County, and a number of other folks. I would just note that this is one of the most successful system-wide programs statewide for reaching young people in terms of how they learn science and math experientially. The purpose really of the Pacific Science Center is to train the trainer. So they teach teachers how to teach science, and they do a really great job at it. They have some of the most successful low-income programs serving foster youth in the entire state and are a model for cultural and art organization outreach to foster youth and low-income youth statewide. So with that, I very much appreciate your sincere consideration for this very important cleanup bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I know we have three people signed in to testify, and I see them all here. So I'll start with, I'll let you guys decide who wants to go first. Looks like Will.
Yes.
All right, welcome.
Chair Office and members of the committee, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. I'm Will Darity, CEO of Pacific Science Center. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 5080 today. As you've already heard, 2 years ago, the legislature took a big step to provide the Science Center with local financial support for capital improvements. We are very grateful. Support for operations has become critically important, and this bill provides us with much needed flexibility. The additional flexibility has no cost to the state, but the entire state will benefit. The bill enables us to maintain and grow the services we provide, especially to low-income youth. Prior to COVID-19, we provided free or deeply discounted science education programming to more than 70,000 youth each year in underserved communities throughout the state. We served families and schools in every one of Washington's 49 legislative districts through our access memberships, our outreach programming, including Science on Wheels in local schools, libraries, and community centers, and experiences at our facilities in Bellevue and Seattle. COVID-19 has had severely adverse financial consequences for us, but we have not stopped serving and innovating. we developed virtual education programming to help youth, families, and educators cope with the challenges of remote schooling. Since the beginning of this current school year, we have delivered 170 virtual programs to more than 7,500 students. Another 73 programs with more than 5,000 students are already scheduled, and registrations are increasing every week. These programs are completely free to Title I schools. This bill enables us to sustain and grow these essential education programs while we also invest in technology and facility improvements. I thank Senator Carlisle and the other sponsors for bringing this bill forward. I hope that you will support this legislation. The need is urgent. Action in the current legislative session will make a big difference. Thanks very much.
Great, thank you. And don't let Senator Carlisle off the hook. Ask him for some capital money. Who's next? Is it Adrian?
Yes, thank you, Madam Rolfes and committee members. My name is Adrian Brown, chair of the board of directors at Pacific Science Center. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I joined this board because of my deep career connection to business, science, and innovation. I was particularly interested in our science education outreach. Pacific Science Center's Science on Wheels is an extraordinary program where our educators marry STEM concepts with hands-on activities adapted for every grade delivered over the course of a day. At the onset of the pandemic, the team launched virtual science programming utilizing those very same principles. With special emphasis on serving young people who have historically been left behind, we deliver our educational programming for free or discounted to youth in low-income communities in Title I schools in every part of the state. Whether at the iconic Pacific Science Center facility at Seattle Center, or our facility in Bellevue, or School Science on Wheels Day in Spokane, or the Tri-Cities, or through our new virtual educational experiences, we build skills needed for Washington's future. We contribute to the state's economic and social well-being. As the region's science center, we know our work is more important than ever. We need financial flexibility for our survival and renewal. This legislation answers that need and has no cost to the state, but has high statewide impact. Your support of Senate Bill 5080 is critical for us to continue that momentum as a force multiplier for Washington State youth, especially for those who've been underserved. So please help us continue this important work. Thank you.
Thank you. Jason, you are the last person signed in to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jason Barnwell, PacSci's chair-elect. I serve PacSci to pay forward what I can't pay back, and I'm here to talk about the future. And that means even more to me on this day. I'm an assistant general counsel at Microsoft, focused on innovation. And my role builds on my experiences as an attorney and an engineer. I live the transformational power of STEM on the human experience every day. My capacity to contribute builds upon investments people like you direct for the benefit of us all. I want more people to have access to opportunities so they can achieve more. And PacSci is an opportunity engine. It systematically grows the value of the resources we give it by creating STEM access across this state. And our state needs equitable access to STEM education to produce the next generation of physicians, scientists, engineers, teachers, and public officials. Activating technologically capable people is a critical input for our state's employers to create future economic success. And curiosity and critical thinking are necessary for an engaged and informed electorate. PacSci's mission creates access for Washingtonians that drives these outcomes. We'll use these resources to create new educational experiences that can start helping Washington's learners now. This includes in-person and virtual programming that is essential to close opportunity gaps in our underserved communities. We will work with great partners like Climate Pledge Arena and Seattle Center to be a beacon for our shared renewal experience coming out of these times. Our region has a bright future, and we are committed to driving these outcomes. So we're grateful for your support and leadership now more than ever. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. That concludes our public hearing on Senate Bill 5080. There were 12 people signed in not wishing to testify, but in support, broad range of organizations. Senator Carlisle, even though Pacific Science Center is in your district, I recognize that it is a state asset. And I thank you for taking care of them with this bill. It's my understanding there is no state, there's no fiscal note there to the state. Just checking in with Senator Carlisle.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Okay, Senator Kaiser, we have looked all over the internet for John, and he is not here. So
I thank you very much.
Yeah, we will close the public hearing on that. If you have contact with him, please ask him to submit his notes to the rest of the committee. And that concludes our meeting of the Ways and Means Committee for January 18th. Before I bang the gavel, since I have no eye contact with anybody, I want to make sure that Mary and Liza think we've done everything we need to do. One of you guys pop up and say good to go?
Yep, we're good to go, Senator.
All right, very, very good. Thank you all for being here today, and we'll see you later in the week. Bye-bye.